Well, a few things come to mind regarding the way Buddhism is set forth by Tibetans. Well, these are the people that introduced it basically to the West, Tibetans. But it seems because of the situation we're in the 21st century, there are some parts not missing. They're not missing for the Tibetans, but they're missing for us. And they need to be introduced. And nowadays, the lamas, they do start introducing these parts. And I've already mentioned it before, this idea of self-hatred, which we may have. And I'm not saying we hate ourselves all the time, but at times we do. There are times when we're frustrated with ourselves, and we feel depressed, and we feel grumpy, and we just see the negative in things. So Tibetans are actually different in that way. They're quite different. They have a very relaxed attitude, and no matter how miserable their life are, they're always able to see something positive. And I think that's an incredible attitude because, sometimes we can't change however miserable the situation is, however many problems we have. And there are times when things go really well, and then there are other times when just everything goes wrong. It's interesting, there's something about, and I've talked to quite a few people about this, like when someone passes away close to us, and very often shortly afterwards another person passes away, and it's like it seems to be like a chain of events, or like when something bad happens and then something else happens, and there's like almost like one after the other, one after the other, one after the other. So from a Buddhist point of view, there's this explanation that, well, karma ripens, and then another one, and then another one, so for us to experience, to have those experiences. Of course, it's also the karma of the person to die. But since we're interdependent, sometimes there's a common karma that ripens for us and for another person. And for us, it may be a row of three or four events that really put us down. So, I mean, modern science has found if we have a positive outlook, it's just much healthier, right? And I think that's something in the West. Health is such a big issue, and it's important. I mean, especially when I look at your breakfast. Come on, that's so healthy. Such healthy breakfast. Oh my God, American breakfast is so not healthy. All these pancakes and bacon and eggs. There seems to be a lot of emphasis on health, I was thinking this morning. Yeah. And especially in this group, I don't know everyone. I mean, there are definitely people in Israeli society who are not that keen on health, but definitely there's a great conscience about health. But of course, if we're physically healthy, right, extremely important, our mind is happier. But likewise, if our mind is happier, we're physically healthier. So there's that interdependence, which is why it's considered so important to have a healthy mind. And healthy mind means to learn to see the good in things. I don't even want to use the word positive thinking. It's like such a like this kind of magazine type kind of, it's in like any kind of magazine, you got like a positive thinking kind of article. It's kind of like get tired of this term. But actually that's what it is. We are kind of conditioned sometimes. We condition ourselves to just see the negative in things. Right? Oftentimes in a situation. And that's where the grumpiness, I'm glad the grumpiness came up. Grumpiness and bad mood. Well, actually, when we talk about anger, a lot of this makes sense, but when we're grumpy in a bad mood, all this kind of falls away. Then the grumpiness, the bad mood takes over, and it's very hard to apply this. So I think it's really important to find a kind of calmness, a kind of contentment, and seeing the good in things, seeing the positive, understanding how incredibly lucky we are, actually. So this, of course, it actually exists already in the Buddhist kind of teachings of the first subject being, well, one of the first topics being appreciating your precious human rebirth. But it's kind of like, oh, we've heard it so many times. It's like, yeah, right. And I know about these. And that's another problem. In the West also, we're so used to new information. We want to get new information. We want hear new things. So we heard about the precious human rebirth. We don't necessarily go through it again. Whereas Buddhist teachings are very much about repetition. Again and again and again. And every time if you listen with a certain type of mind, there's a certain type of mind, which is not the intellectual, because then you just go, oh, I heard that before, that's boring. No, but within, listen within, kind of allow yourself to be touched with it. Like, how does this affect me personally? How about my own personal experience? And then every time you hear the same thing, it is new, because you have changed in the meantime. So your experiences have changed, you have changed, therefore the information is new. So especially when there are teachings by the Dalai Lama, for example, that someone highly realized, which affect us differently. Teachings by His Holiness affect us differently, so whether they're in the form of a book or something else, if you just take to mind His incredible qualities, or even if you don't do that, on a certain level they affect us differently. And then listening to the same again and again and again, if we listen with the right kind of attitude to allow our hearts to be touched. I don't know how else to express it. It's not just intellectually, but really within, deep within. And almost take it like a personal advice. Well, not just almost, actually take it as a personal advice, as if His Holiness was speaking to me. Right? Like, to me, what is my own experience on the day-to-day basis? How does what He says, how is that relevant to me? And there's always something we find, right? Simple things such as getting angry makes us unhappy. All right, how is that true for me? Last time I got angry, was I happy or not? Does it solve the situation or not? Long term and so forth. So that's one way to understand, okay, repetition is good if I don't listen to it just with like an intellectual kind of attitude, but really an emotional attitude. But then to find that peace of mind, that kind of calmness and acceptance, that is so important. Because without that, we're too distracted to actually take it further, to absorb things. So I was thinking this morning, what is a good technique to do that? I mean, like, because it's not really in the scriptures, because Tibetans have it already. Very calm, happy go. You know, they're terrible with stress. Terrible with stress. I can't deal with stress. So with my classmates, it's very funny, you know, like we had to get a bus or something. They'd rather let the bus go before they're stressed out. So let's just have a cup of tea and take the next bus. So then don't deal well with stress, because they're so calm in general. But we can deal with stress, and, you know, we get all uptight. And we don't have that calmness, necessarily. We do sometimes, but not all the time. And I think one of the first steps, one of the first things we really have to learn is to be mindful. To kind of slow our life down a little bit, slow it down a little bit. There's oftentimes too much distraction. So maybe, I mean, the distractions with our family, they're there. And there's nothing wrong with those. But we can find a calmness in the kind of daily life distractions. But then maybe cut down on the times we watch TV. Because TV, gosh, it's really made for distractions. I mean, especially nowadays kind of TV. If you watch a movie from the 50s or the 40s, things are much slower. You know, the guy in the rain for like a long time. Now it's like, what, you have those half an hour series, you know, where you need to find, you need to have a killing, you need to find the victim, you need to, you know, it's like all packed in half an hour. And we understand it. We get all the clues. It's very fast. And how do I know how fast it is? Because my dad had a stroke some years ago. And for him, things have to be slower. So he hates Miami Vice and, you know, these kind of series. You know, these fast ones. Because he doesn't catch it. It's too fast for him. He needs the slow ones. So when I was with my dad, and, you know, sometimes that's on. He's like, I don't want this. I mean, he can't say that anymore. He can't speak anymore. But it's like, no, not this. He wants a slow German soap opera that lasts for like an hour and a half, stretched out drama. So, you know, it's like, this is what our life is like. It's very fast now, much faster. We're not content with the slow stuff. We need it fast. And then we got the internet, right? Initially, the internet, I mean, wow, so fast. But now we need it faster. I can't wait. We click on something and, oh, takes a second. Oh my God. Right? Or 2 seconds. Oh, this computer is useless. This line is useless. We need it faster and faster and faster. right? So in the everyday kind of life, anything, you know, food is faster, preparing it is fast, cars fast, everything faster, 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 faster. And so our mind is faster, right? But then there's that calm, very hard to get that. So maybe we should go down to slowing things down a little bit, take more time, because we don't really get that much more done. Or maybe you do, but in the end of the day, we're kind of stressed out and we're grumpy and we spend a lot of time just being in a bad mood because, you know, it's so fast. So to just slow things down, maybe a good idea. Less TV, less internet. I mean, it doesn't mean stop it, but instead of half an hour, maybe 15 minutes, right? And spend more time just being calm. I think that's definitely a way of just, you know, becoming aware. How can we be mindful if there's so much else around us to be mindful of? So mindful means to be mindful of the self, but we're mindful of the things on the internet and Google and you know, I mean, there's no time to do that. So to really get back to that time, to like slower pace, you know. And then, of course, whatever we do, being with our children. I mean, they can be pretty fast and active, but still find that calm just being with them, right? And also looking inwards. That's such an important part too. To accept ourselves for who we are. Because we can't do that. We find it hard to be with ourselves. I mean, we are with ourselves the whole time. But we seek distractions. We want to be with people. Like, we can't, you know, too long. Ooh, being on our own. For some people, that can be very hard. So to find comfort, being with ourselves. That's also very important. Find that comfort. It's okay. And we need acceptance of who we are. Very important. The way we are, we're fine. So the different analyses, some analysis is sometimes given. Yes, please. Oh, no. Okay. There are different analyses or different metaphors given, like our look at your mind as a garden. You know, a garden. Some beautiful flowers, but some crappy stuff there. Some weeds there, too. Right? Always changing, always growing, changing. You know, some things dry up, other things grow newly. And it's just a matter of taking out that which we don't want and, you know, cultivating the rest. So a bit like a garden. Well, Nissim probably can identify with that, like a garden. And first we just accept the garden for what it is, you know, just look at it and be curious. Oh, what's there? So like an acceptance. Not that, oh my God, ooh, don't want to look at this. Ooh, that's like scary places. You know? I mean, it's like this book by Pema Chodron, such a great title, The Places That Scare Us. Yeah, there's certain places that scare us. And if we don't look at them, we choose not to look at our mind altogether. We just kind of push it away, and then we're in trouble. Because change can't take place. So then actually to build on top of that ideas of compassion and love, very difficult. There's no solid foundation. Right? And we stress ourselves out and rubber band effect and, you know, the whole kind of we do too much, we have no good measure. So even though Buddhism is so much about not being selfish, not being egotistical, but to first focus on the self, it's not egotistical, it's not selfish, it's realistic, it's something positive. So therefore, yeah, to look inwards, to kind of find first, to focus more on ourselves, but not in a kind of exaggerating the importance of ourselves, but more in a way like curiosity. Who am I? Right? Just from here to walking to your room, just looking inwards. Who am I? What am I thinking? In all moments, and make it a habit. Make that a habit. And then also learning to see the good in things. Appreciate a lot more, like when you get up in the morning, right? Just appreciate that cup of coffee. Really enjoy that cup of coffee, right? Or the hot shower. Appreciate the little things, right? We get used to, so it's a bit like, usually we look further for something else, or we're so distracted thinking of the past or thinking of the future. And it doesn't really help that much. The past is gone. Just to remember what's happened. What's the point, right? I mean, yeah, there's certain constructive kind of remembrance, learning from our experience, but just reminiscing, like going on about, oh, what's the point? Or the future. The future is totally uncertain, right? To worry already about it and to be already, I mean, it's just worry without needing to worry. Tibetans say, leka mebe leka. work without work, unnecessary work, unnecessary worry, right? And just be in the moment. Enjoy what you have in the moment, right? Having your kids around, enjoy them, just what's there. You know, enjoying the person you're with when they're happy and calm. Like maybe they're grumpy in the afternoon, but who cares? Right now, let's just enjoy the happiness. So enjoy the things for when they are. It just calms things down a little, you know. And we find a sense of satisfaction within. And only then can we build. From there, we can actually build and take it further. And that's also very healthy for the mind, for the brain. Mindfulness, they say. Scientists have found that mindfulness, it thickens the cortex, the gray material. There's more gray material is being built up in the prefrontal area, in the hippocampus. In specific areas that are very important for resilience, for example. So when things happen, when problems happen, you know, with this mindfulness, finding that peace of mind, that space in the mind, that calmness, then whatever happens, we don't get kind of drawn into it and carried away by it. We can kind of sit back and think, how can we solve the solution? How can we find a solution? How can we solve the problem? So I think one of the reasons why Tibetans were so good with the Dharma was because they had that calmness in the beginning, that kind of, you know, contentment. So to get in touch with that, I think is very important, right? To find that sense of contentment. Or, well, also, of course, this positive kind of to look at all the good things in our lives. Because again, this bad mood, this kind of grumpiness, it all comes from just seeing the negative. And sometimes when things go bad, what's worse is that we think things go bad. We go on and on and on. I'm just exhausted. Right? And it's the power of the mind. It's really interesting. Sometimes I found, sometimes whatever I do, I feel really exhausted. But then what makes it worse is thinking, I'm so exhausted. Oh, I got more work coming up. I'm so exhausted. That makes it worse. And one day I tried to think, I'm so fresh. I'm really fresh. So much work. Right? It was totally artificial. I wasn't thinking that way. But I made myself think, I'm so fresh. I'm so lucky. Much more work. How fortunate. How great. You know? And it's like kind of faking it until you make it, that kind of idea. Fake it until you make it. So it's like, and slowly I started feeling, oops, that gave me more energy. So I found really what was dragging me down was thinking again and again, oh, this is bad. This is negative. So then I forced myself to think, oh, this is great. Right? And just talk to myself. I mean, we talk to ourselves the whole time, actually, internally, right? It's this constant chatter. You were saying yesterday, it feels like that's what the I is, that constant chatter. So we just control that chatter a little bit. Oh, it's great. I'm so lucky. Things are wonderful, right? Things are really, and you really do that and you make it a habit. And this is, of course, when you look at it from a scientific point of view, and we're very much trained in that area. I mean, even though we're not scientists, but we're very much influenced by that. What happens in the brain? New synapses are being made, right? And they're strengthened. So I think every time we do something with our mind, there's something happen on a physical level. So if we kind of always go, oh, it's negative. We don't use the kind of positive area in our brain, and it withers, right? I once heard there's like the part of our brain, it's like, which is a kind of Darwinism, survival of the busiest. So if we keep the part of the brain busy, like a positive thinking, right, then that's becomes stronger and these synapses grow stronger and stronger. And when it comes down to it, you know, when something negative happens, we have that habit. We've left an imprint, to talk about the Buddhist kind of side here, where it talks more about the mind, right? The mind leaves an imprint. But of course, what happens in the brain is a certain synapses, a new synapses is being created, and that's strengthened. So then when something happens, we kind of tap into that, right? And right away, oh, we see the positive. We can see the positive. And then it's much easier to deal with anger. Much easier. Okay, so that which is, it seems very hard right now with the anger. I mean, some of it I'm sure you listen to and you go, yeah, it sounds great, but no, not for me. That's already, okay, you have already made a new synapse in the mind. Okay, can't do it. Already, it's like, That's the greatest obstacle, whether you can do it or not. Actually, we're all equal in this room. We can all do the same thing. We can all be like the Dalai Lama, actually. But we believe we can't. And of course, this is just on a coarser level, on a conscious level. But then there's so much happening on a subconscious level. It's unbelievable. If you start watching your own mind, how you're not even aware of something, and still your body reacts in a certain way. Then you get to see, wow, there's so much happening on a subconscious level. So we haven't even been able to tap into that to make those, you know, subconscious thoughts, you know, be able to control them. But we have to start on a more coarser level. So, in other words, what's important, to go back to that kind of positive attitude, to remind ourselves every morning how fortunate we are. To think, oh my God, and I said this previously, you know, remember when I told you when I got sick, and then when I got better, suddenly I appreciated I have two hands. It's the silliest thing in the world, but when you don't have them, then things look different. So sometimes to imagine, if I didn't have all the great stuff I had, if I didn't have the great, you know, children I had, if I didn't have this, if I didn't have this healthy body, just imagine. And then you go back, but I have it. Wow, how lucky. That's also beneficial to think like, how about if I didn't have the good stuff? If I didn't have a car, if I didn't have a house, if I didn't have this, that, you know, if I didn't have a tongue, or if I didn't have eyes. Come on, it's not like we cannot lose our eyesight, we cannot lose our tongue, we cannot lose our, I mean, no certainty, we don't know. So to appreciate those things, those little things, but they're not that little. They may seem very little, right? But they're actually so big, so important, much more important than that better position at work, or, you know, my children going to a certain university, or, you know, I don't know what our daily worries are, that bigger car or bigger this or that, you know, they're much more important. These things are much more important, and we have them, and then we worry about something else, right? If we think about this. So there's this expression, count your blessing. I don't know where it comes from. Probably some religion. I don't know. But there's really something to it. Count the good things. Really count. Make a list. Yeah. And this reminds me of something I found so beautiful. There was once a teacher. I'm sure you've heard this story. There was once a teacher who made her pupils at the time of, I don't know, there was some, you know, students were really distracted, and so she couldn't really go through with her lesson, and so she asked her students to write down the name of everyone in the class, you know, on a piece of paper, and then write something they thought that was beautiful about that person, right? And then everyone had to pass around these pieces of papers, and everyone had to write about something positive about this person. So we should actually be able to do this ourselves. But here, they did this, you know, she made the students do it. And sometimes we don't see these incredible qualities we have, but others see them in us. And everyone got their list later on. Everyone got their piece of paper, kind of. She wrote it up, and everyone got, and they didn't, you don't know who wrote what. But you see this, and it gives people so much strength. And they say that afterwards, these kids dispersed, you know, went out into the world. And they didn't meet until a long time, until one of them, he had been in the army, and he was killed. And so some of his classmates came together again, and the teacher was there too. And they said the one thing they found on him was that list with his good qualities he carried with him. And the teacher was like, wow, I didn't think, you know, this was. And they said, you have no idea how this changed our lives. So one used this list as their marriage vows. You know, they based their marriage vows on that list. And they, you know, it's very important for them. So you see, I mean, this was other people. These were other people's pointing out these, you know, positive qualities in us. But we need to find those ourselves, because, you know, we have those incredible qualities. And we get in touch with that. It gives us a strength. It gives us confidence. We can really love ourselves. So this whole love and stuff, you know, how can we love others if we don't accept ourselves and don't see the beauty in ourselves? We can't see the beauty in others. So we really need to find the beauty in ourselves without exaggerating, kind of, oh, I'm so great, I'm so much better than anyone else. No, from there you take it and say, wow, others are just like that. So the good places you find within yourselves, or maybe have others find them within you, right? in this situation, I think it's such a wonderful way. You get in touch with this, I mean, through this technique the student, the teacher utilized. So in that way, or just maybe ask someone, can you say a few things that you appreciate about me, right? Sometimes when things don't look too good, and ask them and write them down and look at them and recognize them in yourself. So I think that's so important. So important. Without that, no. Buddhist practice, very difficult, actually. Because then we cannot love others. Then we cannot understand others, see also the positive. Because if we only see the negative in ourselves, we do the same with others. We have that negative kind of outlook. Does that make sense? So this we really need to work on. So with Buddhist practice, we need to start where we are. And if I'm honest, those are the things that really help me. Tantra and I don't know. You know, little bits and pieces I can make, I find helpful. The hot bodhicitta, you know, like some parts of it. Yeah, they inspire me. They're beautiful. But do I think I actually practice? No. Come on. It's totally beyond myself, right? That's not where I am. So I need to start. So I know the things that I find right away beneficial, those are the things I need. And they are this accepting myself, where I am, positive outlook. When things get really bad, well, look at all the good stuff I have. You know, tell myself, no, things are great. It's okay. It's all right that way. And see the positive. How can I learn? What is the positive part in that? And that's the power of the mind. Right away, it changes because it's that little voice in your mind that keeps telling you, oh, it's not good. It's not good. I recognize that voice. It's important to recognize that voice, right? How is it talking? Ooh, it's negative, 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 right? Okay. And from there then, and I want to go a little bit through what we've learned as a kind of repetition. Because now you hear it again, and listen to it, please, in a different way. Not intellectually. Yes, you've heard this before. But like, you know, with a heart. So just say a few things of what His Holiness has kind of taken us through. And hopefully with this attitude. You know, like an acceptance of who we are and the determination that we try to look inwards, you know, more often, generate that mindfulness. Okay, so that's important. When you leave this place here, it's a bit like, you know, like an exercise. We do the exercise in the morning, you know, like this, you know, running around or something in order for it to affect us the entire day, right? So likewise, what we do here should affect us when we leave. And then if we start like a daily practice, we develop a daily practice. We do some meditation in the morning, even if it's just 15 minutes, half an hour. That should affect us the entire day. Yeah. So do mindfulness in the morning and try to be mindful. Every now and then, remind yourself, oh, what am I thinking? What's happening? What's happening? And kind of go inwards. Make that a habit. But then from there, you know, when anger and frustration, and anger doesn't just mean like anger, you know, like hatred and aggression. We may not necessarily have that, but just that sense of irritation. Just check when you're not feeling well. Just check when you're not feeling well. Like something is just not right. Oftentimes we find there's a type of anger, type of frustration with something, with another person or with ourselves. Okay? And those are the times then to see, well, first of all, you know, does this protect me in any way? And of course, you know, just the fact that we're unhappy when it arises, obviously it doesn't protect us. And with regard to other people, the thing that's so beautiful with this book, that after each chapter, you have like a summary of points to just think about. So it's like a summary of the chapter, and it helps you to, you know, remember what was in the chapter. We may not be able to remember this. So here's Holiness, well, it doesn't look so much towards anger that is directed towards the self, but more towards other people. And, you know, when we have this frustration and anger, irritation with the people around us, and usually, oftentimes, it's our spouses, right? If we check well, the kind of anger we can feel for, you know, in a certain moment, it's much stronger than towards others. Yeah, so towards the people we're close to. So understanding that kind of anger, if it's lived out, it can only cause disaster. And there's a sense that it gives us a sense of satisfaction, actually, when we let it out. No doubt about that. But that is short-term. Very short-term, it does not solve the situation. So if we just want to, it's a bit like, you know, you have a wound and it scratches. So instead of really doing something about the wound itself, we just scratch it and there's a short relief, right? We just scratch it for a moment and there's a short relief. And then we go on and it goes on and on and on and on. And it possibly grows bigger because of the scratching. Anger is like that. Anger is like that kind of wound, you know? It's like you give into it, you scratch it, yeah? And then it gets a little bigger and bigger and bigger. Sadness and depression, they have to be expressed. Expressing them oftentimes takes care of the problem. Anger that is expressed grows. It's just in the nature of anger. Try it, right? Try it. If you practice patience for a month and you're a lot less angry, and then one day you're just like, whatever, let it go and just be angry, it's much easier the next day, right? Next situation, it's already, the habit has become a little stronger. So therefore, it may give us some brief satisfaction. It may solve a problem. It may just get rid of it swiftly. But it's only extremely superficial. It doesn't really take care of anything. So that's also important to understand. And the other thing is, when there is an angry situation, when there is a situation, this is also something His Holiness says here, if we react with patience, most of the time, or tolerance and a kind of acceptance, most of the time, the other person's anger goes as well. Because anger is the fuel of anger. Love and compassion, you can't keep that up. So if someone approaches you with an angry kind of fashion, you know, someone on the street, someone you don't know, wow, what are you thinking? Ma! What are you doing? I don't know. Right? I can hear this word sometimes on the street. Ma! Maratza or something. Right? So then just, if you react with calmness and like have a gentle smile on your face, and it's like a sincere, gentle face, they're like, you know, can't help it. They're kind of affected by that. So that's a very good way of diminishing the anger. So that reaction, it usually, you know, touches the person and affects them. And we were very much interdependent. So reacting with kindness and so forth, it oftentimes, you know, diminishes. And I talked about this before. When someone really attacks us, if we react in a calm way, to kind of like find that space within and listen and see, is there something to it? Oftentimes there is something to it, right? It's not like it comes out of nothing. And then say, kind of really take a moment to think. Already that for the other person is like, oops, they're thinking about what I'm to say. Instead of reacting right away, they're actually thinking about it. So take a moment and you go, there is actually something. Oh, that's kind of helpful. Well, thank you for pointing it out. And before you know, they go, well, thank you for listening. It's almost like they feel embarrassed, right? I don't know whether they've had that experience. So if it's sincere, not if it's faked. If you fake it, they know. I mean, we can fool people for some time, but we can't fool all the people all the time, right? It's it's like the song says, it's true, right? We can fool them. I mean, yeah, we can fake it, but people actually are not stupid. So therefore, to react in that way, and you can diffuse the situation in such a powerful way. Right away, you can take it out. And that's it. When you go home and, you know, maybe have some hummus together and right, enjoy the day. No, I'm just kidding here. But usually, I mean, also with our partners, right? With our partners, like, we're often in these situations, like, he says something, I say something, he says something, I say something, and like this usual pattern, you know? And then dot, 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 no end. It's always the same, very similar pattern. Like if I watch sometimes people and they argue once, they argue twice. Oh, that's very similar to before. Tuck, 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 tuck. And so sometimes just beforehand, okay, he's or she's going to say such and such. But what is they're trying to understand where they're coming from? Really try to think why they're saying that. Maybe there is something I'm doing wrong here. And then when they say it again, to kind of say, oh, it's interesting. I've been thinking about this. You know, there is something to that. You know, and to kind of say, yeah, you know, I could see, but, you know, and then if you kind of have that openness and say, yeah, I think there's a fault, I did something wrong here, but you know, if try to understand, like, I'm doing this, but it's coming from such and such place, and then it allows them to see, oh yeah, it allows them to understand. So to create that understanding, I think, is really important, because the moment we understand where someone is coming from, it's very hard to be angry with them, Right? Because we're all the same. We're actually all the same. We don't want the same thing. And we want the same thing, basically. It's the same thing that we don't want, and it's the same thing that we do want. So we're so similar. So we have to create that understanding. And also, when someone tries to take advantage of us, that's another one. That's difficult, especially when we were very kind to them. We've done a lot of things for them. Again, before we do something for someone, to think, take a moment and say, it doesn't matter what their reaction is. It doesn't matter whether they thank me or they don't. I do it just for the sake of it. Right? Then you don't expect anything back. And when it comes, it's fine. And when it doesn't come, it's also fine. Because you're doing it for the reason just helping them. Right? So again, there's no disappointment. And when people try to take advantage of us, to see also their human nature, and it's much easier then to not just see our perspective, but to look at them as, you know, okay, they kind of try and understand them. They're just like myself, but due to certain causes and conditions, they try to take advantage of me. But if there's this kind of like me and them, if that's a little overcome, like if we overcome that by putting myself into that person's position, and creating some understanding, then it's much easier to take it. It takes away some of the heaviness, right? We don't take it personal, in other words. Most of the time, I like that expression, we take it personal. It's actually not personal. Most of the time, they're just their own kind of, you know, disturbances, frustrations. They make them do those things. And they harm themselves much more. So understanding that, I can kind of take it and go, okay, right? Of course, there's the Lojung text. Offer the victory to them. Accept the loss and offer the victory to them. That's very powerful. I will try my best to offer, if someone takes advantage of me, who I've given great service and who I've helped many times, so without gratitude, they attack me and abuse me, I will offer them the victory and take all the loss. Wow. It's like the opposite usually. It would be totally the opposite. We feel justified and it'd be the opposite. But here it doesn't mean, this is just an internal kind of attitude. It's not external. Externally we still can be stern and strong, and you know, because they're really harming themselves by taking advantage of anyone. So we should stop them. But internally, okay. Like with our children, it takes it back to that. This is why I'm thinking the one thing I missed out on is the love for children, because that's totally beyond me, actually. I find that really fascinating. I find that very fascinating. The strong love that mothers have for their kids. It's like my sister, her baby is like so ugly. How could she love this baby? Initially, it was really ugly. I thought it was ugly. And I was like, oh, such a cute baby. I thought it looked ugly. It was just born. It was wrinkly and red. And I didn't think it was pretty. My sister thought, oh my God, you know? And then from then onwards, it was like, this child, wow. And I'm like, you know, difficult sister relationships. So anyway, but incredible. It's like incredible, that love. So those of you who've experienced that love, I mean, you understand that you can always see the good in your children. You can always see the good. You're able to look past the negative. Right? That's, if we can do this with other people, just extend it to other people, because they're not different from our children. They're not our children. Okay. Not in this life. Okay. But they're actually very much, so I think mothers are very lucky. Mothers, not just mothers, fathers too. Sorry. I always forget the fathers. Mothers and fathers, likewise. Very lucky, because they can usually see the good in their children. And the love, I think it's something that doesn't stop. I don't think it stops ever. And so therefore, whatever happens, like I said, a serial killer, often it's just the parents who are left. I mean, I look at these cases in the United States where like someone goes into a school and kills all the children, right? Horrific. And then I see them sit there, you know, often there's their picture on the news. And I'm wondering, who is left to love them? And I can only come up with their parents. Usually it's their parents. They're probably the only people left. Everyone else hates them, right? So incredible. That love is incredible. So it shows we can all do it, because everyone can be a parent. And you know, I don't think there is anyone who doesn't love their children. It may not look that way sometimes if the relationship is complicated, you know. There may be a lot of fighting as their children grow older, but anyway. So to find that place in others too, to be able to see the good in your children, well, other people are like children too, right? But doesn't mean we don't react strongly, because we don't want our children to harm themselves. So we do, you know, we can be firm. But that's not the attitude within. And then in the next chapter, and I'm just, as I said, I'm going over this just as a kind of review, and I take the last pieces where His Holiness takes us to the kind of through the meditations. So learning that negative circumstances to learn to see those as valuable. And as you pointed out yesterday, we need to start where we are. We need to take that in small portions, because that can be overwhelming. So really, to be realistic. Realistic is also important. We can take this much, but again, when we become mindful, we learn more about our limits. This much I can take, this much is too much. To find like a good middle between being lazy and just, I don't want to do it, and doing too much. Doing too much is a problem. And we have a tendency as Dharma practitioners to do too much. That's a huge problem. That goes back to the rubber band effect. Then you really have, you try something too hard and you go into the opposite direction. It's like anything. It's like physics. It's like, you know, stretch one thing too hard, it goes in the other direction, right? Or it breaks. So that is also important to take, not to do too much. Don't stress yourself out. We take our habits into the Dharma. We stress ourselves out when we work. Well, we stress ourselves out when we go to the Dharma. Yeah, to really learn that, to not do too much. But when circumstances arise, negative circumstances, well, to kind of have more of an acceptance. It's part of life, right? We seek an ultimate lasting happiness. Well, let's stop looking for that in samsara. Let's stop looking for that in relationships. In, you know, we don't find it there. That lasting happiness, it's just an illusion. We don't find it there. But that's okay. If we have a realistic outlook, it's not going to last, however great it is. Enjoy it for as long as it lasts, right? The relationship you're newly in love, it's not going to last. I mean, really feel that, not just intellectually. It won't be like that. You know, then trouble starts, you know, to set in. And it's work. Having a relationship is hard work, right? Having children is hard work. And, you know, the good things are not going to last. So to have that acceptance, and the negative things really build character. And this is something I noticed the first time I came to Israel from Germany in end of the 80s. And I was in a kibbutz. Actually, when I left high school, I came to Israel to be in a kibbutz. So if you wonder, it was Alamot. People ask me where kibbutz was. So I usually... So it was kibbutz Alamot. Never mind. So when I first came, I noticed a maturity in Israelis that I didn't possess myself. So, you know, boys and girls my age, I was like 18, 19 years old, they were much more mature than myself. Much harder, much tougher. What do you call the Israelis? They're like this fruit from a cactus. Sabarim, yeah. Yeah, like hard sabah. So hard from the outside, sweet from the inside. There was something really special about Israelis. It was that resilience, you know, to deal with problems, and that non-pretense. There was no pretense. That's what I still find with Israelis. You sit down with them, it's like you know them forever. No pretense. Just talking like, you know, in Germany, for example, you know, like in Europe, there's like this kind of like, we went through no hardships. Like when I grew up, I went through no hardships whatsoever. Everything, I was packed in you know, in silk by my parents. There were no problems in Germany. It was all kind of hidden. So after the war, and then, like, you know, the what's it called? The economy was, you know, going upwards. We had no pressure at school. Any job was available. Oh, you can do anything. Word is your oyster. But no hardships whatsoever. We didn't have to work at home a little bit, but then we always chickened out. And my parents were anti-authoritative. We're like, oh, I mean, anyway, didn't go too well. So I had no discipline whatsoever. And I came to Israel and I was so immature, like a baby. I was such like a baby. So because I was wrapped in you know, in just comfort and no worries, and my parents kept all this away from me. And then I came here and I was like, oh my God, this is embarrassing. 17, 16 years old once. I'm much more mature than me. So this character, that rawness, that honesty, that was because of the trouble here, I believe, because of the difficulties. And also British people were like that, because at that time there were a lot of problems in Britain, you know, unemployment, the island kind of conflict, you know, all that terrorism and all that. I think it really builds character. It makes people special. And the Tibetans are like that. And they actually believe that. Like my classmates would say, you know, I'm resilient. I'm strong. I come from a family. I'm used to this trouble and this trouble and this trouble. And they're like, I should experience more trouble because that's good. It makes me stronger. They actually have that attitude. I mean, they really grew up in a country where it's, you know, it's like, oh my God, the cold and the difficulties. I mean, leave alone the Chinese, you know, all that trouble. But there's the constant kind of like, you know, every day, like you need to keep warm. You have to be in lots of people in the room, otherwise you freeze and the food is difficult to get by. And, you know, all that. And you're up in the mountains. And yeah, it's tough physically. So here it's tough, you know, physically, of course. Well, it was in those days even tougher, I guess. And it makes people stronger. It builds character. It gives inner strength. And that I found Israelis have, inner strength. And a kind of a natural compassion towards others. So there's like a, that's why I think the Dharma works well in this country. Because people have already that kind of resilience and that curiosity, you know, that kind of like, I want to know. So that intellectual is there, you know, and then is there. Enjoy that. People enjoy that. You enjoy that, right? But at the same time, there's like an inner strength there. And that's because of difficulties. So, I mean, however hard the circumstances in Israel are, there's some good to it. You know, with the trouble and all the difficulties that you've gone through, it makes people stronger. And understanding that, it's much easier to embrace difficulties and not just push them away and get afraid. And, you know, it's like, okay, difficulties really build character, inner strength, and so forth. Yeah. And when you get out of it, if you see it in the positive light, you'd be so much stronger and much more resilient. Okay. And like, yeah, so those people like, you know, who are wrapped in, I mean, they can't take any difficulty. They're not mature. They're not in touch with reality. We often find that those people who, you know, I don't know, I'm thinking of Paris Hilton or, you know, these women or men who always had everything, were wrapped in silk. I mean, they don't know about life. They're not in accordance with reality. I mean, their attitudes are not in accordance with reality. Okay, so this is something Solness very much stresses, and the Tibetans do all the time. Yeah, all the time. They actually say, I don't want to stay in a fancy hotel. I want to stay in a rough place. I mean, they have that attitude, like, I want to have it rough. I want to have it rough. I'm lucky I grew up. And you look at the lamas. I mean, they say, I'm lucky I grew up in a poor family. I'm really lucky. They see it that way. I'm so lucky, you know. We had lots of hardships. I had seven sisters. One of my classmates had seven sisters. And the lamas, if you look at the lamas, they're usually born in very poor families that struggle, right? Yeah, considered to be better for the growth of character. Okay, so that also, of course, and regarding the practice of certain qualities like love, compassion, patience, actually we need someone to be patient with. So it's lucky to have a so-called enemy. I mean, enemy, it's a strong word. The Tibetans use the word enemy. But enemy could also just mean someone we dislike or someone obnoxious that gives us trouble. Someone at work. I mean, there was in the US, people talked about that a lot. There was this obnoxious person at work, right? Oh, that was so difficult. My life is so difficult. That person was just gone. But actually, how lucky to have this obnoxious person. It doesn't feel that way. But how lucky, actually, to have an obnoxious person in your life. You see it that way, because how are we going to practice patience? Nice people cannot teach us patience. Right? It's the obnoxious ones. And whether there's an obnoxiousness with our partners, then we're lucky when they're obnoxious sometimes. Or, you know, that person at work or our neighbor. You know, I mean, sometimes we're lucky to have an obnoxious neighbor. We don't see it that way, but, you know, it's just a matter of attitude. So Solness is saying, therefore, understand that in this way, enemies or people we dislike, obnoxious people. I don't like to use the word enemy as much, as such, because it's such a strong word. But obnoxious people, well, I mean, whether they're obnoxious or not, that's to be seen in the first place. I mean, that's a matter of attitude. But those that cause us trouble are very valuable for the opportunities they provide. It's the opposite of what we usually think, right? Decide that instead of getting angry with those who block your wishes, you will inwardly respond with gratitude. It's like, again, this kind of decide, right? Make it, fake it until you make it. I mean, first we need to, of course, see the value in that. Is there anyone who thinks that's total rubbish? Please be honest. Be Israeli about this. Just tell me the truth. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Oh, every time you have to switch it on. Good, very good. Okay, very good. Suppression is a problem. So this is definitely so. Yeah, I know what you mean. It just kind of say, okay, I will just be now nice. I will be nice. I will be nice. That's a kind of suppression. But if you use reasoning, if you sit down every now and then and think that really makes sense, it really makes sense, then it comes almost naturally at some point. You can fake it a little bit, but then if you also put in some reasoning, and it's the matter of habit. So what you're saying, it's like you do it once, you do it twice, and before you know, it becomes a habit. Mm-hmm. 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 Right, okay. No, force is a no-no. No force. Okay, maybe it's again the Tibetan kind of way of talking about things. There's actually no force involved. So it sounds very forceful, but it's not really force. It's like just making it's almost like in the morning I'll wake up at 5 o'clock. I really try to wake up. That's not a force, right? It's just a kind of your determination. So maybe more of a kind of, so I really make an effort with this kind of strength of mind. I'm really going jogging tomorrow. That's not forcing yourself, right? I need to jog. You know, it's good. I've just read the whole article about why it's good to jog, right? That's how I do it. Isn't that like that? That's how I exercise. I don't exercise. So like I read something. These are the points why exercise is good. And I can do it for a whole week. But then I never go back to the article, I forget about it and stop exercising. So this would be, of course, the importance. You read this article, right? It's like you read something, why it's good for you to eat, I don't know, whatever, something. And then you start eating that. So it's like first you do the analysis. The reasoning makes sense. You come to a conviction. And then you can actually build that determination. I will do this now. Does everyone know what I'm talking about? I don't know. Do you have that same experience? I do that all the time, you know. Some stupid article I read, why such and such exercise is good for you. And then I do it, right? Or why such and such is good for you. And I do it. Unfortunately, I don't keep up with it. So that's the art of it, to keep up with it. So it's a bit like that kind of psychology of the mind. See why it makes sense. And at the end, you say, okay, I'll do it. And you actually have the strength of mind to get up and do it. Or like in this situation, like, so it should be natural. It is natural in that case because you gained a conviction. And that conviction, together with that determination, allows you to do it. So without conviction, can't do it. Can't do it. Don't do it. Without conviction. That's why I check with you. Does that make sense? If it doesn't make sense, let it be. Don't do it. Don't force anything. Because force means repression. Yeah? Does that make sense? So think of it a little bit maybe like that. Kind of you read about a certain exercise, about a certain thing. Right. Yes, as we all do. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's not a technique. It's not goal oriented. No, I'm so interested in hearing this. How is it not? But that it helps you, that's the goal. Right? That's the goal. Yeah, so it's like a healthy body. One thing is for a healthy body. You know what we read about fiber and so forth. Here, this is for a healthy mind and a healthy body. Right? This is kind of the goal. And if you take it further, of course, there's the goal of liberation and enlightenment. But let's be realistic. Is that really in the back of our mind all the time? No. All right? I mean, keeping that in the back of our mind is good, but let's just be, you know, make sure our lives are happy right now. But it's interesting. I like to hear these kind of inputs. It's interesting because it, you know, allows me to see possibly my own problems with this. Yes. Yes. Very true. Okay. Well, you see, actually, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be, of course, because we should bring everything onto an emotional level. We have to, because otherwise we don't change. It's the emotional that changes us. It's the emotional intelligence that we need to get in touch with. It's not the just the rational, but the rational can be a stepping stone for some people. Whereas, like, first you just take the rational, and then you allow it to get to an emotional level. Sometimes it's just a door. For you, it's the opposite. Okay, then great, because you found a technique that works for you personally. So I think that's important to get in touch. Of course, it's another way of learning about yourself and learning how these techniques individually work better for you. So if it's really like just from an emotional, then that's the way to do it. Yeah, wonderful. I think that's wonderful. Yes, first it was you. Yes, next to you. Yes, yeah. Yes. Okay.
Which is more difficult. Someone hit you, someone comes to bed. Just go and become better and better and better. Then go and try to be play if you like. Someone uses me. Not to try to be nice, but to try to play. Try to see if they can do it, to try to bring it into like some kind of game. Okay, this is my challenge.
So am I understanding you right? You're saying it's much easier to have an external discipline if some external kind of input. Is that right? Is that what you're trying to say? Like, it would be much easier, like with the yoga. Okay.
I'm sure when there is this brain, it would be much easier for us.
Structured, kind of. Yeah, like a structured, like, I mean, God, that's the hardest. I mean, that's the hardest. It's so much easier if you're in an environment where everything is kind of prepared. You know, it's a bit like, it's so much easier if someone else does the walking for us. It's a bit like that, right? It's so much easier. It's like anything. This is the challenge. I totally understand what you're saying. To build your own discipline, in other words, to actually have a day where you, no one tells you you have to be there at that time, but you're just going to do it. Right? So to have that exercise, that's why I think is exercising without that discipline. So that's why I think exercising without other people can be so hard. Because if there are other people and they kind of pick you up and they take you there, then you just do it. Whereas if you on your own, that's one of the hardest things. And trust me, as a nun, you know, if you're like in a monastery and there's, but even then there are like puja times and then most of the day there's other things. And once you finish your studies, then you have to find a way to be disciplined. And initially I was just lying there, you know, just not doing anything. And I had to build, that's a great challenge, but that's wonderful. That's another kind of, what do you call it, challenge to live up to. I know it's hard, it's very difficult, but this is the, that's the true discipline. Otherwise you have someone else, you're walking on crutches. I mean, we do these we do those retreats to be able to do it on our own. That's the only reason. It's not like you should go into retreat. Actually, these group retreats don't even exist with the Tibetans. They do these three-year retreats together sometimes. But most meditators have their own routine every day. And that when the time comes, they're ready to do it. And that's part of the challenge, to build that ability of the mind. Because we're naturally lazy. It's uncomfortable. And unless we are forced by others, we don't do it. This is the challenge. Because you need to, these kind of retreat situations, they're artificial. And they're good, you know, for some time. But you need to still learn to find your own discipline. Because otherwise, your whole life, that's not your life. That's just taking time out and helping you to find that discipline. But your life, you need to integrate it into your own life. That's the challenge. And I tell you, I know exactly what you're talking about. From my heart. I know. And as Western monks and nuns in Dharamsala, that's our problem. Because we are very much free. I mean, we don't live in the monasteries because they're just not suitable for us. Or we don't have a space to live there. So as long as I studied, I had a certain routine, but once I was out of it, living on my own and, you know, teaching and so forth. So for the teaching work, I would not do exactly. But the rest, oh my God, to have that discipline. It really took me a year or two to figure it out. So it's something to develop. Yeah. And you find ways to do that. Okay. Yes.
I would want to understand that initially taking an object for to us the beauty is generated. And then probably started to someone who is maybe neutral and then go to
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. To have compassion, yeah. Okay. Yes, what you're saying is very difficult. I mean, you're so right. Actually, usually the way love and compassion are generated, you try first for the people you like or the ones you don't care about. Definitely. Now here, we're right away kind of thrown into those who cause us trouble. But this is what I'll introduce this afternoon. I want to talk more about how to generate compassion and love and care. But there's one other state of mind that needs to go before that, which is called equanimity. So without that sense of equanimity, because we'd have a preference towards some and push away the rest. So if it was your cat torturing your neighbor, it'd be all right, right? Because your cat is more precious than the neighbor. So to find that equality, how, you know, this neighbor was your cat at some point and the cat was your neighbor, like looking at it a little bit that way, there's almost like more of like a distance. And then the cat becomes less important and the neighbor more important, right? I mean, not less important in the sense like you don't care about them, but that kind of like, oh, they're so precious, as opposed to him or her not being precious. And that gives us a distance a little bit more. And it's easier then to spread that love equally. But I want to talk about the techniques, because again, there are techniques. Those are introduced in the afternoon. And your problem is also my problem. It's not like I can talk about it, you know, in a certain way. But that's just theoretical. It's very hard. I have definitely more difficulty. Of course, it's natural. But it doesn't mean it's impossible to lessen that. And again, we're so lucky. That's why we do the long life prayers also at the end of this class. For His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, for example, which means all the lamas, actually. When we do these long life prayers, we do them for all the lamas because we want to have them hang around. I mean, they hang around anyway, but such that we can actually communicate with them and perceive them because they're such good examples. I mean, as I said, the obnoxious person, the kind person, whoever, equal. And you can actually see it. Yeah, so that's such a good example. It's possible. So if they can do it, I can do it. But again, it takes time. Yes, I think you were next. Okay, sure. Yes. Get drawn into it. Same as me. Of course. Any strong emotion, it's a strong emotion, and you get drawn into it. But I think one of the first steps is to recognize that. That's incredible. I mean, already incredible that you can do that. You're aware of that. And I guess it's just a matter of not giving up. Yeah, and then one time it seems like impossible, and the next time it seems a little possible, and a little more, and a little more. It's just with habit and not giving up. That's the thing. You see, it's not that hard to meditate, but it's hard to do it every day. Right? To continue doing it, to build a habit. That's like exercising. I don't know how many people actually regularly exercise. Good. Wow. That's amazing. Actually, you have that discipline. That's very good. It's similar to exercising, actually, right? It's sometimes hard to do it, and then you don't do it, and you don't do it one day, and 2 days, and 3 days, and that's it. So it's the same kind of mechanism, except here it's also it's for the mind, really, and for the body in a way. Yeah, that helps. That helps. Just as the regular meditation classes, those help, right? I mean, you have those classes, like meditation classes, study classes, to maybe join those, right? So, and do some retreats sometimes, you know, kind of get into that habit. But understand that it shouldn't become a crutch. Yeah, it should just be like a way of doing it, build some habit, and then you go home and you do it on your own. You're able to do that. That's real strength of mind. Yeah, but hard, of course, difficult. Yes. Yes.
Just about feeling the coming. So I meant to work with the anger, but I really need to work on my sadness. And sadness.
Okay.
And I tried sometimes to just fake, I'm happy, I'm smiling, and then I know that it works for me.
Right?
So I know that it works, so
okay.
That's not a problem.
Okay.
But then sometimes I get into this like bad mood, like very depressed, and then I don't fake the happiness. I don't know why, because if I know it can work, and I know it works before, so why I don't choose to be happy? What is the barrier? So
oh, interesting.
So I thought maybe one option is maybe that all the time I was told that we need to work very hard in order to get it. So maybe if I just, I can just grab it, you know, just from, like,
right.
I can't just be happy.
Okay.
Or maybe it's a lot of responsibilities, if we really believe that we're responsible for our state.
Okay.
If we know for sure that we can be happy when we choose, so we cannot blame anybody but ourselves.
You mean that's, those could be the two reasons. One would be that there's nobody else to blame but ourselves. So that would be one reason why in that situation you just don't want to fake it even. And the other reason was that it's not supposed to be that way. You were trained that way to be kind of like working hard and to be depressed. Not depressed, but to not be always happy. That's just not the way. That means you're not working hard enough.
Yeah, not that, but if a solution can be so easy.
I see. Okay. It shouldn't be that easy. That's too easy. Okay. Interesting. Interesting. I think, I mean, what you're saying with this kind of like, I want to say something to the first part that sometimes, you know, like I'm saying, I've been in that situation. I felt really tired, but I just decided I'm fresh, you know, and I knew I wasn't, and I knew I was just pretending. So I wasn't really like a repressing, but that actually, that thought gave me some freshness. So I was like, I'm fresh. It doesn't matter. I'm really fresh. And then that kind of gave me some freshness. So there's something to that, but it's not that reliable. I mean, I still go to sleep, right? I still go to sleep. It doesn't mean like I'll be up all night because I'm fresh. No, that's silly, right? It's just when it's like, it could lead me into depression, being tired. When I know this could be a problem or lead to discouragement, then I'd rather, you know, pull myself away. But there's only something, I can only do it to a certain degree. And I need other techniques too. So that what you're saying is in certain situations, you know it helps you, but that's more superficial kind of sadness. So you can pull yourself back easily. This is not the best technique. It's just a tiny technique that helps. But when it's really, when you're really down and really, then we need to look at the cause, like deeper, what's underlying. It could be physical. That's also, you know, I mean, this whole thing about in the West, it's just such a stigma to feel depressed. But why? 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 It shouldn't be a stigma. We should be able to talk about it and say it. And I'm glad you do. I mean, many of you do. So that's great. And even taking medicine, who cares? We take medicine when, you know, if it's necessary. Sometimes if there's some physical, chemical kind of disorder, well, get the chemicals right. We do that with aspirin and so forth. I mean, be careful. I'm not saying, you know, but I'm also not like extreme saying like, oh, no Western medicine at all. I think sometimes Western medicine for the time being, maybe there's something better, but unless we find that, maybe go in that direction. But of course, without medicine would still be the best because of the side effects and so forth. So then if it's not physical, it's got nothing to do with chemical imbalances, or maybe we could eat certain foods, exercise, and these chemical imbalances would be also taken care of. But that's, again, more physical kind of solution. But then mentally, what is the underlying cause? And you know, sometimes it's funny, our attachment may even get attached to our sadness, right? That's also something. I don't know whether you've noticed that, but we kind of have the sense of ourselves. And I'm a sad person. I'm a negative. And there's almost like an attachment to that. That's another obstacle to letting go of the sadness. So where am I just totally identifying with being in a certain way, right? And maybe someone said this one day to me. It could also be that. Sometimes someone says something and we hold on to that. Oh, since you're a sad person, there's also something mature about you or something. And we want to be that mature person, so we really want to be sad. It's almost like we can't be that without the other. Right, so it's kind of like the tricks our mind plays, right? So to recognize that, and should it be that easy? That's a good one. That's really a good one. Shouldn't it be much harder? I should actually be, because life is hard. But that, I don't know. Maybe just living with the Tibetans and having people all around you all the time being happy, no matter how bad it got. That kind of was like, why would I want to be unhappy? You know, it's like if you see that and you observe it in others, and it's good to look. Of course, there are other people around too, but many people I saw them, they, you know, so life sucks. Why make it even worse by being unhappy about it, right? So I guess it's just a matter of attitude. I don't know exactly what your cause is there. You'll be the only one to be really, you know, you can find that out by digging deeper and see, is there something someone said? It's like watching your thoughts. And these thoughts will creep in every now and then it becomes more obvious. Yeah, I cannot give you the reason for it, but one thing I think we sometimes attached to our own kind of like, there's something positive we associate with that and we hold on to it. And we have to make a choice. Right? Do we want that, or do we want to just be more light and you know, and it's better for ourselves and others, actually, for everyone else around us too. But it takes time. I mean, all this, what I'm explaining here, it takes so much time. There's so much time. So let's not be in a rush. Let's not do too much. Let's take a step at a time. And as I usually say, there's no deadline. And what better is there to do? Right? I'm not saying stop working. I'm not saying stop being, you know, do the things you usually do, but bring that into your life and take it slowly, right? And if you have time, instead of reading lots of magazines and, you know, lots of novels, take some time out and maybe get a book by His Holiness, you know, and read that. They're not that hard to read. To do a lot of reading is good, like to study in that way. But study with this emotional, right? Kind of like taking it emotionally. Instead of just intellectually, if that's your tendency. And if you're someone else who likes it more, you know, the kind of intellectual, then you do that. Okay. Yeah, so step at a time slowly and see and know that change is possible. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So I said, okay, but you know, actually, every day somebody, you know, sick or have some trouble.
Right.
Even though I don't think about it in this few minutes. So sometimes this helps me to give me more motivation to have more space in the day to practice.
Right.
Because that for myself only is like.
It's okay tomorrow. Yeah.
After and finish the art, so then
right.
Time is gone. So if you think about it in the morning or in the evening, whatever you think you will have the time.
Right.
It helps me to give me more motivation to do it.
Uh-huh. Right. Then it develops a habit. That's beautiful. I mean, I think all of us have a natural tendency to be compassionate. And we can see that when we're very much steeped into our own trouble and someone comes along and says, I'm in real trouble. Suddenly our own, I need you, right? And it's like, my own trouble is gone. Oh my God, that becomes our focus. We try to find a solution for them, right? That shows our naturally compassionate nature. That's who we actually are, like, really. So, but we need to get in touch with that. And I think that's beautiful to think that, and that's actually the truth. This is actually, I mean, if you go to certain places, I think it becomes obvious. I think Israel is a very blessed place. Why? Because the place has been changed by the people. Because it's such a religious place. There's also the conflict, but it doesn't go back that far. But there's mainly it's a place where people, you know, practice their religion. So that changes a place. So whatever thought we have, it changes the environment around us. I think Dharamsala is therefore such a blessed place too. You come there, people say, I arrived there, and I have the same experience. I arrived there, and I felt so happy. I felt so calm. I felt so happy. So there are certain places that are changed due to the people. So that shows we actually can make a change. So if you sit down to meditate for the benefit of others, you're actually making a change. Something physically is affected. There's an energy created, whatever you want to call it, that affects the environment. So if you're aware of that, then you sit down every day because there are people all the time and just having positive thoughts. You know, and I'm sure there are some of us here who were in situations that were difficult and other people prayed for them and it worked, right? I mean, they got better or so the power of prayer is just such that an energy is created, a positive energy, and we're all affected by everything else around us. Even the weather affects us. So my neighbor's thoughts affect me. So I can therefore affect my neighbor. By then sending us positive thoughts. Donglen, for example, you know, imagining you take their suffering and you give happiness. It's not necessarily that you take away their problem, but I'm sure it has some positive effect that people are not aware of. But that's still as a profound. So if you have that attitude, that's beautiful to tap into that. People need me and you're really making a difference and you need to feel you make a difference and you do. You know, I mean, if everyone did this, I mean, this place would become even more special. You know, it's like certain places, you arrive there and they're special. Whereas there's other places, you arrive there and they're horrific. I told this story before with Gengetzela. He was in Germany many years ago. And we took him to a concentration camp. I forgot which one. It was not Bergen-Belsen. I used to say it was Bergen-Belsen, but I think it was Ravensbrück maybe. Anyway, one of those concentration camps. And I forgot to tell him in advance. I kind of told him everything else, but I forgot to tell him this is a concentration camp, you know?
Minor detail.
Yeah, I was kind of busy talking to someone in German. There were kind of a few people, and, you know, I had to translate for him, and I forgot. So we got to this place, you know, and it was kind of clean and huge. You know, we hadn't even entered the building yet. And he was like, this place is creepy. What is this place? It's really creepy. He picked up on that energy of that creepiness because so much suffering and so much torture took place. So the whole place changed and he picked up on it. So for me, it was like I knew it and I could have just projected it. But it was so interesting for me to see because he didn't know and he picked up on it. So the place was changed. Even though it was, you know, it wasn't like centuries. It was like, I don't know, 10, 15 years. I don't have very long. It was used as a concentration camp. And still, the place changed because of the incredible intense energy of suffering that had an influence on the structures around. So therefore, both ways, good or bad, Our negative thoughts affect the people around us, the environment around us, and so do our the positive ones. So that's another reason. If you're really motivated by that great compassion, well, you know, there's so much, I mean, people need so much help. And we don't need to look far. It's often just our neighbor who's so frustrated that this poor neighbor has to kick cats to feel some satisfaction. I mean, how sad is that? Right? I mean, if you think about it that way, I mean, how deep do we have to sink to actually have to do that? I mean, how can I kick a cat? I must be really mad to do that, right? So in that sense, like, suffering is all around us. We don't have to look far. So to become more aware, I think that's very beautiful to actually, sometimes when we look at our own suffering and it's so big and it gets bigger the more we look, kind of, and then we just look at others, right? Look at others and see, wow. But not to be drawn into that kind of frustration, because we know it's impermanent, it's changing. So also have the wisdom. You know, it's impermanent. So not to be depressed by it, but just see it for what it is. And it takes away some of the focus on the self, and then we can easily forget about our own trouble. It becomes much easier to bear. And, you know, we get into action. Our nature is actually being utilized. That's our nature to actually help. This is so beautiful. Like, the most selfish people that I know, someone comes up to them and says, They describe them a problem that is bigger than their own. Right away, this person depressed a moment there. You know, it's like, I'm not saying they were so selfish, but they're very steeped in their problems. Suddenly they have all that energy. All right, let's go. Let's do something. Let's do something. A minute before they were like totally depressed, but now they have all this energy. That's incredible. So to get in touch with that, I think is very important. And the Dalai Lama has so much energy. So much energy. And the book starts with, like, Jeffrey Hopkins saying, it's amazing how the Chinese are so scared of him. He doesn't have an army. He doesn't have any guns. He has hardly any political power. No political power anymore, right? And you know, goes to the White House every now and then. He has to leave from the back entrance. That was the last thing I heard. You know, he met with Obama, but he was left out at the back, not the front. So, come on, you know, the Chinese president walks through the front and leaves through the front. Has an army, millions, and they're scared of him. I think because deep inside, they know the power of compassion. The power, he has much more power than the Chinese with all their guns. The power of compassion is incredible. And it's so incredible that the power of anger, we have a sense anger gives us power. And it does. But the power of compassion is even greater. So if you have a lot of compassion, you know, if you have a lot of anger, you can have a lot of energy. I need to destroy my enemy. I need to do something, right? But at the end of the day, you get tired. With compassion, you know, it's all this. Like, you can run and do and things. I think the Dalai Lama, the reason he's never jet-lagged and the reason he goes on and on and on and on and on is because the power of compassion. His compassion is so strong that physically he has enzymes and chemicals in the body we could only hope for creating that. So that's amazing. The power of compassion is much greater. So that's why the Chinese are scared of the Dalai Lama, because of the power of his compassion and his love. Such a power, incredible power. Pardon?
It's more an attitude. The Chinese are more attitude. I think they're conscious.
That he's right and they're wrong. Actually, yes, that this, yeah, that actually, he's right. I mean, yeah, this, what he's saying is in accordance with reality. Absolutely, yes. Ah, I'll do that in the afternoon. Are you going to be around in the afternoon? Yeah, I'll do it in the afternoon. I want to take a break now. But I'll say this much, that maybe the definition helps. The definition of compassion is a loving attitude that wants another person to be happy. Free from suffering. Sorry. Thank you. Good. That was quick. Free from compassion. Yes. So... Let's have a break. Free from suffering. So, of course, if it's compassion towards the self, I mean, you have compassion towards the self. We want to be free from suffering. But then compassion actually is directed towards others, usually, and then the wish for them to be free from suffering. Yes. In which way bigger? Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Right, yes. Yes. Suffer. Ah, it must be bigger, you're saying. It must be bigger because in that moment there really is an actual suffering. Right. I think you're right. I mean, the stronger their suffering, the greater the compassion. Right? Little suffering, you know, it's not that strong, kind of like, you know, okay, may they be free from that little suffering. Whereas if it's a big suffering, may they be free from that. So it's a stronger emotion, isn't it? So the stronger the suffering that you observe, the stronger it should grow in proportion to the suffering, if that's what you're saying. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question? Yes. Yes. Where is it? Okay. Yes, yes. How can you have this in day-to-day life, like all the time? Yeah, that's the challenge. That's the challenge. But to remind yourself that, like, we need to see suffering to have that. Like in a hospital, you can actually see it. But then our thought, that's actually said to be more effective. Instead of going to look at it, if in your mind you become aware of it. It's more difficult. But anything that is more difficult is said to be more effective. So therefore, in really think of the people in the Philippines right now, what they're going through. Really imagine that, what people are going through in other areas, you know, of the country. Like, just think in detail, and then it can arise. And you're not making it up. You're not making it up. It's actually there, right? Certain poverty and, you know, some of the poverty people go through, some of the mental problems that people go through. Just think of a mental hospital, for example. Okay, let's take a break. Would you mind? Yeah, we take a break, and then you'll be the first one to say something to that. Okay. Yes. Okay. Right. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. You're so right. I mean, I would actually also include be free from the limited happiness we have right now. I mean, this goes a little bit further, and I need to do this in the afternoon, actually, to go more into detail on this. But yeah, thank you very much for saying that. All right, enjoy your break.